And the afterlife is depicted as the ultimate anchorage where all physical laws and calculations cease to apply. This profound concept is linked to the Quranic verse that it says, وَإِلَىٰ رَبِّكَ الْمُنْتَهَىٰ. And from Surah An-Najm, verse 42 of the 53rd Surah of the Holy Quran, which means, verily to your Lord is the ultimate return. Everything returns to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Imagine if someone keeps that alive and fresh in their mind. What happens? Every decision that you make, every little tiny step that you take, every little thought that passes through your mind will go through a control system. And that control system makes sure that whatever thought, whatever deed, whatever decision that you make is something that is admittable or acceptable for that day that you go to return to Allah the Almighty. Let's take a quick break and inshallah we'll be back quickly.
You are listening to the program Bridge on Iran Radio.
Our respected brothers and sisters, what I want to emphasize on is that Qiyamah cannot be conceived. And since we live in a world with proportions and do not have a correct understanding or a measurement of a system devoid of proportions, and all our senses and perceptions are accustomed of or to quantitative measures and calculations related to proportions, therefore the infallibles, the A'imma al-Ma'asumin alayhim as-salam, peace and blessings be upon them, speak to us. The Holy Quran also speak to us in a way that is tangible for us. If they make examples, right? If the verses are describing the heaven, for example, let's say, or the hell, for example, let's say, in a certain way, it's just for us to understand it. Would it be the exact reality? Would I see exactly whatever I have been described? No, it's much more than that. Amir al-Mu'minin, a beautiful hadith, says, in this, the hereafter is like this. Hearing about it, seeing it is greater than hearing about it. Because once you hear about it, once you read about it, it's limited to your depiction, right? It's limited to your power of imagination. Whereas when you see it, means that when you confront with it, when you're facing it in reality, once you pass through this transient life, then you see that the reality of the hereafter is much different. Over there, our worldly calculations are not applicable anymore. It's Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala's system of calculation that rules over the Qiyamah, the hereafter. Inshallah, on that day we'll be victorious with the help and assistance from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program Bridge on Iran Radio with Sheikh Mahdi, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
هرگز نگیرد تا ابد آقا کسی جای تو را هرگز مخواه از کف دهن عشق و تولای تو را یا سجا. stars above will always be a shining guide for us to see. And when I doubt, I'll have no doubt, but still I wonder why. Digging through our pages past, wondering how the truth will last. God's in control is what I found. I think I'll try to stop around and know what really feels the path I seek. And no one's gonna care as much as me. And no one seems to know our history. And stories are told for the world to see. And maybe I'll find the path I seek tonight. Let it be. Only God really knows what's right. Maybe I'll find the path I seek tonight. Let it be. Only God really knows what's right. The heroes of our past unfold. Their glory is unique, we're told. The stories mark a precious past, but do we question why? A quest for truth can never be a lot I've faked inside of me. I walk in shoes I've never felt, only then I'll sure know why. They tell me just make up your mind, the path I seek just needs a sign. The end is where I wanna be, which way I go is up to me. And no one really feels the path I seek, and no one's gonna care as much as me.
Out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
And welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. This is a watershed moment in the United States. At least that is what many political analysts are saying about the overall political environment in the country after conservative activist and podcaster Charlie Kirk was killed last week. Now, those on the right are accusing those on the left of declaring war on them, and many on the left are blaming the right for creating a violent and biased environment. There are many unanswered questions regarding Kirk's killing, but what is obvious is that the political divide in the U.S. is not only wide, but many may say it's fatal for the regime. We'll be taking a look at this on this spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Tony Gosling, historian and investigative journalist out of Bristol, UK. And William Jones, political analyst out of Leesburg, out of the U.S. Thank you both for being with me. Let's start off with Tony. Your thoughts, Tony. Do you think that this is a watershed moment in the U.S.?
Well, look, his movement was called Turning Point, wasn't it? In fact, it could be that Charlie Kirk himself ends up being the turning point where many people on the Republican right side of U.S. politics start to wake up to, as Charlie was doing, the malign influence of the Israelis that they spend most of their time supporting the last decades on US politics. But I want to, I think, correct you describing Charlie, because he was a Christian leader. He wasn't an activist. He was a leader. He was a leader of thought, a leader of opinion. He wasn't really your standard Republican, so he was part of Trump's MAGA movement. So he was somebody who you could imagine in maybe 10, 15 years' time becoming part of the national leadership. This is, I think, one of the most disturbing things about this assassination is the fact that Charlie was he was going places. And the other thing is he was adapting. His ideas were adapting to the facts. So he wasn't rigidly pro-Israel. He has been for many years. But over the last few months, he's been, for example, questioning whether there was a deliberate stand down of the Israeli defense forces, the IDF, the army, on October the 7th, 2023. He's openly saying, I think that that's a question that they've got to answer. He's doing many other things to question Netanyahu's wisdom of the Gaza genocide policy. He started calling it a genocide. He started calling it ethnic cleansing. So he was somebody who was his own man. And, of course, we don't like that in the West. We like to have politicians that have one set opinion and stick to it. And, by the way, what they the elite in the West really love is a politician like Starmer who will just read out any script that is put in front of him and doesn't have any set opinions. Charlie Kirk represented the absolute opposite of that, someone with a conscience, a committed Christian who kept Christian values. That's the values of Jesus Christ. Anti-abortion, all these sorts of things. And he actually debated with people who were supporters of the Church of Satan, saying that, look, you know, abortion is wrong, especially up until very close to the time of birth. It's wrong under any circumstances. And our duty as human beings is to protect these unborn children. We were all once one of them ourselves. These are the sorts of values that Charlie represented. And I think that's why he was assassinated. That's why he was murdered, whether it was an organized assassination or, as we saw, I think, possibly with the attempt to kill Trump, there was a climate had been created around this idea that this guy is a fascist, a Nazi, a load of smear campaigns circulated through the mainstream press and on social media that then wound individuals up to think, well, it's going to be a good thing. I'm going to be cool with my mates if I go and kill this so-called fascist. So I think that's really where we are with Charlie, a very, very important assassination that could indeed turn events in the United States to recognize that, no, it's no good for the MAGA and the Republican part of, or any of the Americans to be supporting the Israeli genocide.
All right. Well, William, your thoughts on that. And who do you think benefits, if anyone, from the killing of Charlie Kirk?
Well, I don't know that anyone really benefits from it. I do think it is a watershed moment in a much different way than the previous speaker. It's really a watershed moment for the ability of the American Republic to continue as a republic. There are a lot of divided opinions today. There's always diversity within the American political body. Nevertheless, things have become, because of internet, because of everything, all kinds of information, misinformation being put out on the social media, that emotions can be revved up to a point that lead to such a violent encounter. And I think people are beginning to understand this now. Everybody, of course, is playing it, you know, in their own way for political reasons. But I think the basic ideas, the basic lessons of that were pointed out by the governor of Utah in a speech that he made when they announced that they had caught the killer, where he appealed to the American people to come together to deal with their differences in the open public forum, to discuss the issues, to lay out the facts, and to do it with a sense of comity and with a sense that that we are living in one nation and have somehow got to work together. That's going to be a difficult task going in because of the intensity of the divergences that have occurred over the last 5 to 10 years in the political arena. But this is the only way that you can avoid chaos going forward. It will be a difficult task, but it's really the future of the American Republic as a democracy in which people themselves have the ability both to express what they feel and what they believe, but also in such a way that they are not becoming targets of another part of the political spectrum, which want to eliminate them physically. And I think we have to begin to, I think most Americans are beginning to think of this in terms of, you know, not so much of vengeance, of getting back at alleged enemies, and as far as we can see, this individual who did the killing, we don't know what he was motivated about. We don't know his view on the issue of Israel. We don't know his view on maybe on the view of LGBT, which was also a part of this. We don't know what his views were, but I think in asserting that this somehow is you know is a move in a political game, I think that's just not the case. Other people were convinced that it had something to do with the Ukraine war, that the victim had been very outspoken in trying to get the United States to leave Ukraine and to find a resolution of this, and some people don't like that. But I think it's much more complicated, and we have to leave it to the investigators to see what happened. But I think the lessons for Americans now are to find a way in which we can come back to a situation in which we can discuss our differences, in which we can resolve them in a peaceful way to avoid these kind of things from happening in the future.
Okay, well, Tony, how likely is this to affect the overall political, future political environment in the United States?
Yeah, good question, because I think what we're seeing is with this decapitation, these sorts of assassinations, political assassinations, really the entire FBI in the United States, MI5 in Britain, and in other European countries all have their internal security services that are supposed to be there to make sure things like this never happen. They are the political police, and they're supposed to be the political police. But I think what we're seeing now with the attempted assassination of Donald Trump last year in July, and this now possibly the suspect they've got, Tyler Robinson, for murdering and assassinating Charlie Kirk. These individuals, I mean, what's happening is this same policy that we've been seeing. In other words, the assassinations of political and military leaders in Russia, political and military leaders in Palestine, in Iran, the destruction of many of the senior individuals, including journalists, etc., in Yemen just last week. The idea that these institutions which keep a country stable, its press, its democratic politics, etc., that they are, it's an open season on these. Yes, absolutely right. This is a chaos agenda. But the thing is, we've been used over the last couple of years of seeing the Israelis and others perpetrating this over in the Middle East. And it now looks as if that same mentality is coming back to the United States. I mean, it's a while since we saw high-level political assassination attempts like that of John F. Kennedy in the 1960s, which turns out to have been connected with actually within the United States with the FBI, etc., and the main motivation seems to be towards the stopping of the, because Kennedy wanted to stop the Vietnam War, etc., and they wanted Lyndon Johnson in. There is a very interesting documentary by Laurent Guillenot calling, which explains, which is called Israel and the Assassination of the Kennedy Brothers, which says that Kennedy was trying to stop the Israelis getting Kennedy was trying to stop the Israelis getting nuclear technology at the time. So what I'm saying is, I do think there's, I mean, we've heard from the Grey Zone, for example, that Netanyahu was trying to fund Charlie Kirk. Charlie Kirk refused the money from Netanyahu because he thought that it was tainted. He was starting to turn away, and it's rather disgusting to see Netanyahu put across Charlie Kirk as some sort of Israeli martyr when actually the opposite is the truth. Charlie Kirk was turning away from his support of Israel completely, Marcia. And so I think, again, the main problem here is we cannot allow, none of our security services can allow this kind of encouragement of young people to go out assassinating in the West. It's extremely destabilizing, and it is part of this chaos agenda. So that's why one of the main messages that's got to come out from this is our internal security forces have got to pull their socks up, because there is a chaos agenda out there. There are organisations like the fascist group, the Order of Nine Angles, who are trying to push this, which are still not outlawed in Britain, even though it was invented in Britain. So they need to pull their socks up and make sure these sorts of ways of completely destroying and destabilising a society, the sort of thing that people like Hezbollah and the Iranian government are having to put out, are kept well out of the rest of the world. It has to be contained, but it looks to me like it's starting to spread.
So Tony, let me just get this right. So when I asked the question, who benefits from the killing of Charlie Kirk, to William, you believe that the Israeli regime benefits from this assassination? Is that what you're saying?
I think quite possibly, because he was a very powerful influencer in the United States. As I said, he was a leader of young people. And so what was clearly going on was he was starting to be very negative towards the Israeli genocide. He's refusing funding from Netanyahu as well, which the Grey Zone has publicised. And it's quite clear he was starting to veer away. He was his own man, and he decided that what Netanyahu was doing was enough. He's even questioning whether the Israeli army was stood down on October the 7th. These sorts of things the Israelis will not want to hear at all from someone who's supposed to be supported and someone who in the
All right,
the
stay
past,
with me, Tony. Stay with me, Tony. Let me get William back in on this discussion. Stay with me, Tony.
Please.
Stay with me. Let me get William back in on this. Stay with me, Tony. One second. Let me give you equal time here to William. Stay with me. I know you're very adamant about this, but I mean, William, your thoughts. I mean, there are reports that 1 in 15 Americans now are witnessing or have witnessed mass shootings. First of all, I want to look at this. I mean, what does this mean to the American psyche? And why are we seeing such an increase in polarization in that country?
Well, obviously, there has been really a lack of policy that people feel has benefited the nation over the last 10, 15, maybe 20 years. The American economy, for instance, has gone from bad to worse under the so-called free market ideology that has been practiced over the last few decades. People who 20 years ago, one father of a family could support large families of six or seven children on one job. Today, that is not the case. The shift, everybody knows, between rich and poor, the rich have gotten richer and the poor are poorer. The conditions of life within the United States are abysmal. Even if you compare it with going to Russia today or going to China, even going to China today in particular, you see the differences in, you know, the communication systems, the infrastructure is all going to really to hell in a handbasket. And nobody has had the means of actually changing that, which is partially the reason for an outsider like Donald Trump being elected with popular support from the American population, who realized that we were going in the wrong direction. Now, he has not been able successfully to turn that around. And it's my opinion that he's not going to be able to do that in with his present mode of tariff threats either. But it is a possibility of doing something with this with the right policy. But the fact that that has not been done has created this increasing diversity, increasing split between sections of the population that we saw in the last election or in the last three elections, and which we are seeing today on the streets in the rising violence. This is something that I would compare it to the reaction after 9/11, where people were all of a sudden shocked, wondering what is going on here. That can lead to some elements of craziness if people are not thinking rationally. But if they are thinking rationally, what they would do is, as the Utah governor quite clearly stated, and I think this is the feeling of many politicians, even those who are infected with the zeal for their own political lines, they realize that the country somehow has got to come back to some form of normalcy that is away from this wave of violence or threatening your opponents to with their lives in the political matters. And I'm hopeful that we will be able to use this tragedy, which everybody has been focused on, even those who were supporters of Charlie Kirk, as well as those who were opponents of Charlie Kirk. They also will be affected. They also know that if this type of violence goes on in the United States, they also can be threatened of, whether they're on the left or on the right. And I think that's what you have to use to try and get a focus. And a lot of this will depend on the attitude of the president and the administration in dealing with this crisis. But the task remains at this point that we have got to get away from this continual, very bitter, very angry, and often very violent rivalry in the country, and try and find common interests in which both parties and people from different points of view can come together for the common good.
All right, well, Tony, some political experts are saying that in reality, the under 40 crowd on both the right and left in the U.S. had been coming together on an increasingly anti-war, pro-Palestine agenda, and that this killing actually benefits those who want to keep the people divided. Your thoughts about that?
Well, I'm not sure what effect the killing will have, but yes, that's quite right. As the atrocities go on and on and on from the land of Palestine, so more and more people are starting to think, when is this going to end? And they're starting to realize that Netanyahu is playing a bit of a game with the world for his own political survival. And that obviously hundreds of thousands of people, it now looks like, you know, it's maybe well be into the hundreds of thousands, are going to die. And certainly millions are suffering immediately in Gaza because of this one man's political career. And the world seems utterly impotent. So these facts, after an amount of time, do finally filter through. But when it comes to the sort of violence that killed Charlie, we have to really point the finger, I think, at the mainstream press and also at the social media. We just had a big racist rally with Tommy Robinson in London this weekend. And who should pop up to encourage him? Elon Musk, the owner of Twitter, what is now Twitter. He calls it X, doesn't he? So he's there egging on the racists, saying, oh, isn't it terrible? He's trying his best to divide the country in Britain. And of course, he does a similar sort of thing in the United States. So these people are actually looking at profits coming from their organ. Obviously, they would like to use it for influence too. But they make money. The more people use the social media platforms, and so this is why I think they try and create these massive divisions. You get everybody on there and everybody fighting each other. And the more clicks that people do, the more money Mr. Musk will make. And so this is, I mean, they're virtually non-regulated, aren't they? In fact, nobody's even allowed to know about the algorithms that they use. So somebody who's calling for peace, like I do, for example, will find many of their posts, you can't view it. It says this is sensitive content. This is difficult. So what I'm saying is the mass media and the social media have caused this sort of situation where all sorts of rumors, smears can go 10 times around the world,
right,
have billions of clicks before
okay.
the truth gets out.
All right. Well, William, some experts say that the powers that be want to keep the masses divided so people can make sure that the masses never unite and basically turn their attention against the billionaires that, of course, one of them, Tony, was just speaking about. Is this a divide and conquer type of situation, trying to keep the people from being united? And overall, with this environment, where do you think the U.S. is headed?
Well, it's absolutely the case that this is being used, the conflict, the rivalries, the heated debates are always a means of keeping people divided against what is their common interest. And but I think that the ultimate result of this may not be, I don't think, in favor of the country of Israel. Look, Charlie, as the former speaker pointed out, was moving against the genocide in Palestine, talking about it to people who generally consider themselves on the right. And of course, if we look at all the demonstrations that are happening at the universities, these are people who generally are trending toward the left. I wouldn't say that they're all leftist. People who are in the middle of the road are also upset about this whole situation. It's something that we haven't seen since the Second World War, of an entire, you know, group of people, entire nation, really, being decimated or threatened with decimation by a single power. And I think what may very well happen out of this, to the extent that people do not use this as a cudgel against their political opponents, which maybe even the administration, if they would move in that direction, would be a very bad move. But I think there is a possibility of using this, and even using Charlie's own words on this, to unite those elements who understand, one, that the country is moving in the wrong direction, and two, that what's going on internationally, in the Middle East in particular, in this genocide in Palestine, and also the war in Ukraine, which is also being fomented by those same political elites who realize that the world's population, even in the country, in the NATO countries, are being opposed to this war. They want those people divided
okay.
in order for the policy to go through. I think there's a possibility that we can use this in a positive way to move forward and bring
All right.
together.
And on that note, I thank both of you. I'm out of time, but I appreciate you, Tony Gosling, historian and investigative journalist out of Bristol, being with me, and also William Jones, political analyst out of Leesburg, being with us. And thank you for staying with us right here in the spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Goodbye.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Good morning to all listeners from around the world. You are tuned into Iran Radio. It's very nice to have you with us. We start this hour's lineup with our radio productions feature. Dialogue will be next. The program looks at the most important conversation between Shiite imams and their followers, questioners, and leaders of other Islamic faith and sects. That will be followed by ulama's speech. In this program, we broadcast excerpts from the speeches of well-known and reputable Islamic scholars. Our varied radio productions feature will be our final program this hour.
We've been here to the United States a lot. We used to come every year for a vacation, and we really liked the U.S. We saw it's a great country.
This is a huge country. This is a beautiful country. This country is country for everybody.
That's why we decided we wanted to continue our life and move here to the U.S. and have a future here in the U.S.
The Megaheads are the perfect picture of an American immigrant family. Samir Megahed, an engineer, moved from Egypt with his wife and four children to a quiet cul-de-sac in Tampa, Florida, in 1998. Samir found work, and his eldest sons followed in his footsteps, pursuing engineering degrees. In 2009, the family celebrated becoming American citizens. But their son Yusuf was missing.
A friend told us, how is Yusuf? We told him, he's fine. He went to a beach trip with some of his friends. He told us, did you see CNN? And we were amazed that he was telling us to check Yusuf on CNN.
In August 2007, Yusuf Megahed was on a road trip with his college friend Mohammed, visiting beaches in the south. They were pulled over for driving 60 in a 45-mile-an-hour zone in the small South Carolina town of Goose Creek. But when Mohammed told the officers he had homemade fireworks in the car, they were both arrested and charged with transporting explosives across state lines.
We saw this as a mistake that hopefully will be solved by the next day. But then the story didn't end the next day, and it continued now for almost 2 years. He was arrested with fireworks. If any white kid or anyone who's not a Middle Eastern would be stopped by a police officer and he would have fireworks, they would consider this to be something ordinary, and they are going to the beach and they are having some fun. But for a Middle Eastern, even this legal stuff that is enjoyed or allowed for any person living here in the U.S., it's considered to be banned or illegal for him. So I think it was almost like a wake-up call that like Arabs and Middle Easterns and people from an Islamic background, they don't enjoy the same rights or same freedoms offered to other people here in the U.S.
Although no formal charges of terrorism were ever filed, Yusuf was held for 10 months in solitary confinement. It was over a year and a half before his trial began.
In the past 2 years, our life is changed completely. It looks like a nightmare. You live under pressure from the biggest government all over the world. If the biggest government all over the world targeting your son, and you know your son is innocent, you're thinking it's crazy. Because Yusuf has a Middle East face and he's carrying Quran, his suspicion on him.
Justify their hatred.
Stop all Muslim immigration. Is that the best way to protect America and our economy from new terror attacks?
The fact of the matter is, these guys want to kill us. We have to fight them. And we have to support law enforcement who want to fight
them.
You know, Clinton goes all over the map here. We got to get these guys before they kill
innocent. And that's got to be the last.
If you are an 18 to 28-year-old Muslim man, then you should be strip searched.
So there's
Thank
always
you.
Confusion about Islam. Is it a religion of violence or peace?
Islam is a violent, I was going to say religion, but it's not a religion. It's a political system. It's a violent political system bent on the overthrow of the governments of the world and world domination.
In the years since the September 11th attacks, advocacy groups claim that the United States has witnessed an anti-Muslim and anti-Arab backlash. Issam Zayem is president of the Cleveland office of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, or CARE. Nationally, CARE has tracked a five-fold surge in civil rights complaints by Muslim Americans since 2001.
The atmosphere and the environment in the media had created a very false perception about Islam and Muslims, especially American Muslims. So we were all lumped in the categories of the fifth column or the terrorists. If you look into the major cities in the country, you will find that there has been major cases all over the country.
The Department of Justice is waging a deliberate campaign of arrest and detention to protect American lives. We're removing suspected terrorists who violate the law from our streets to prevent further terrorist attack. We believe we have Al-Qaeda membership in custody, and we will use every constitutional tool to keep suspected terrorists locked up.
The U.S. Department of Justice refuses to release a tally of how many people it has detained since the beginning of its so-called war on terror. From 2001 to 2003 alone, however, at least 27,000 Arabs and Muslims inside the United States were detained and interrogated by the FBI, and 7,000 arrested. 145,000 Arab and Muslim immigrants were questioned as part of a special registration program, and of those, nearly 14,000 had deportation proceedings started against them. Sami Hammoudi was a PhD student in applied anthropology and an instructor at the University of South Florida, the same university Yusuf Megahed attended as an engineering student. He and his family had moved to Tampa from Palestine in 1992, so Sami could pursue his studies. In 2003, he was arrested as a co-conspirator in the Sami Al-Aryan case and charged with terrorism.
Today, the United States Department of Justice is announcing the indictment of Sami Al-Aryan and seven co-conspirators. All of the defendants, if convicted, face the potential of life sentences. Al-Aryan's U.S. associates and Palestinian Islamic Jihad members arrested today include Sami Hammoudi.
At the very beginning of the case, I thought that there are misunderstandings.
They came around 4 a.m., 4 in the morning. They just came knocking on the door very strongly, and my wife woke up and we opened the door. Then they came to me and said, "You are under arrest for charges of terrorism, for supporting terrorism."
Rabia Haddad came to the U.S. to study in 1980, fleeing the violent civil war in Lebanon. After a career with various aid organizations, in 1992, Haddad founded the Global Relief Foundation, or GRF. It became the second largest Islamic charity in the United States, providing aid to 680,000 people worldwide. In 2001, he was living in Ann Arbor, Michigan, with his wife and four young children. He worked as the chairman of GRF and volunteered as an imam at the local mosque. 3 months after 9/11, the government designated his charity a terrorist entity.
They raided our offices December 14th. It was a Friday. And I remember coming home after the Friday prayer. I felt that I was being followed coming back from the mosque. But I didn't think, you know, I thought, well, if they're raiding our offices in Chicago, it's, I think, normal to put me under surveillance or, you know, whatever. But then maybe an hour after that, they knocked at my door and arrested me. And things went downhill from there.
The theory that gave, let's say, legitimacy to all in their thought to all of these actions was Muslims and Arabs are either terrorists or potential terrorists. So we have to do things to control these communities. And this is what they did. And this is what they are still doing. Nothing changed.
Back in Tampa, Yusuf's court-appointed lawyer, Adam Allen, worried that the prevailing political and media climate would make his case nearly impossible to win.
Initially, obviously, when you are appointed to represent somebody from
the Middle East originally, who is charged with the transportation of explosive materials. As a defense lawyer, you have some great concerns about the ability to successfully represent this individual. The media reaction was that this was some sort of terrorist-related activity. The United States Attorney's Office, although not saying that, certainly wasn't saying it wasn't. And that sort of swelled around this case.
Gary Meringer served as the foreman of the jury in Yusuf Mugahid's trial. He says the tone for the trial was set on the very first day.
The judge asked, does anybody here consider themselves an expert with explosives? And he followed that with, is anybody here fluent in Arabic? And not knowing at all, when you go into being paneled on a jury, you don't know anything about the case, just some person sitting there in a business suit, and all of a sudden I'm hearing Arabs and explosives, and it's like, whoa.
I mean, if you ask the man on the street, hey, the defendant's from the Middle East, and the government's alleging he's got explosive materials in his trunk, all of my colleagues said, there's no way you're going to win this at trial.
We listened to almost two full weeks of evidence. 40-plus witnesses were put on by the government. I don't know how many documents. It was, I think, over 100.
As the evidence came in, and it kept pointing away from Yusuf, and it kept showing that, you know, if even though there was no physical evidence tying him to it, once it became clear that these items were completely harmless, I felt we should win at trial, and we could win at trial.
The jury, after 3 days of looking hard and fast at the evidence, said, you know, it's the burden of the government to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he was in possession of these materials and that he knew it. It's not sufficient that you happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. You're not guilty of a crime in this country. And there was, the feeling was, you know, there really wasn't any evidence of that.
When the verdict was not guilty, it was a wonderful feeling. There were tears from the client and the family, and probably the best hug I've ever received from my client's father. Several of the agents that worked for the FBI came up and congratulated us and told us that they were not dissatisfied with the verdict in the case. And it was good to know, and I think I was even quoted in the paper as saying, you know, the system worked. As a lawyer who tries cases and understands the Constitution and the purpose of jury trials and the whole notion that the jury is the true representation of our government, it's a check on our government, and it's what makes us America, is that it's not the government that decides whether somebody's guilty, it's the community, because we are government of the people. And the people in this case, despite all the government's best efforts, said, you know what, you're wrong. It was about one of the proudest days I've ever had as a lawyer professionally. It was wonderful.
We went in and talked to the judge. He counseled us never to talk to anybody ever again about anything that had happened. And as a result of that, we all took all of our notes and all the charts and everything, and we just gave them to the bailiff to shred and burn, and thinking we would never, ever revisit this.
Well, he was acquitted of federal explosives charges just this past Friday, but today Yusuf Mugahid is back in the hands of federal agents, and his family tonight is outraged.
On Friday, after a three-week trial, Yusuf Mugahid walked out of a Tampa courthouse a free man.
I'm very happy.
Mugahid was acquitted on all counts of federal explosives charges, but his freedom was short-lived. Monday, to the surprise of his father, Mugahid was arrested all over again.
They kidnapped my son.
Samir Mugahid, Yusuf's father, says they were walking out of this Walmart on Bruce B. Downs when more than a dozen customs enforcement agents surrounded them.
They separated between me and my son, and they surrounded me. I tried to use the telephone. They didn't allow me to use the telephone, and put the Yusuf in a small car. I tried to stop in front of this car to let Yusuf to speak to his lawyer. They didn't allow me to do this thing. They kidnapped my son.
I would have personally walked into wherever he needed to be, but instead they chose to surveil him for days after the trial and to arrest him and his father as they were walking out of a grocery store. and to surround them by cars and agents and whisk him away in a vehicle.
Tuesday morning, I got to work. I opened up my browser, pulled up the news, and I saw that Youssef had been arrested on Monday at a Walmart with his dad by immigration authorities. And this has only happened, and I was thinking about this morning, when I saw the Grand Canyon was another example, but where the air got sucked out of my lungs. I read the story and was like, like that. It just was so improbable. After all the time we had spent to find out that he hadn't done anything.
I spend a lot of my time telling the government they're wrong. That's what federal public defenders do. We tell the government they're wrong, and we argue that they're wrong, and we argue what they're trying to do to our clients is wrong. But we respect the system, and we were a part of the system, and we believe in the system. At that moment in time, not only did I not want to be a part of the system, but I didn't want to be an American. I was no longer proud of our system, and I was certainly not proud of our government.
Many a time, you know, I'd be sitting in my cell all alone, and I would have this slit in the wall that was about maybe 5 inches wide. That was the only window to the outside world. I would only see shadows and, you know, the colors of the sunset, but never really the sun. And I would sit there and wonder if I'm ever going to see a sunset again. Of course, to this day, not a single charge has been filed against GRF or against any of the employees of GRF, including myself.
I was acquitted from all charges, and in the media, the jurors were saying that we didn't know why they brought him to the case. They took the first decision in half an hour. They voted without any discussion that I was innocent of all charges.
They didn't have enough to bring criminal charges, to charge me as a criminal, as a terrorist. The only accusation they would make against me is that I had overstayed my visa.
I was acquitted. The second day in the morning, ICE came. My attorney asked the judge to release me, but the judge wouldn't accept that.
The lawyer had told them that, like, he should be out in like 2 or 3 days, just until they process the paperwork and everything. And we kept waiting, and then they transferred him to the immigration facility. And every time we would keep trying, like for the first, I think, week or two, like even like my dad's lawyer couldn't get any information on what's going on. It wasn't something that was like unheard of, and it wasn't something like that I thought couldn't ever happen, because I saw it happen or I've heard of it happening, but it was just, I didn't expect it to happen to my father.
I was denied bond based on the fact that they considered me a danger to the community, when my whole community was actually demonstrating and protesting and what have you. And they were treating me like the most dangerous, worst criminal ever. When I was taken from my cell to my first immigration hearing, the security they had was unbelievable. They had a sheriff's deputy stationed almost every 10 feet all the way from the door of my cell to the building almost next door. My trial was behind closed doors. I was put in solitary confinement on a floor all by myself in a very tight cell. And they had a camera fixed right on me. The cell door had a small window, and the camera was right there. It was clear then that this wasn't about immigration or me overstaying my visa or anything like that. They were going after me with everything they got.
One time I passed through the room, observation room of the guard, and I saw my picture there. So I asked one of the guards why my picture is there. He said, because you are a threat, and we have to keep an eye over you for 24 hours. And this was from ICE. They gave them this information.
The thing that got to me the most was just not knowing, like not knowing what's going to happen, not knowing whether you won't be able to see him again, whether he'll, you know, just be there for, like, these major events in our lives.
Very quickly, we presented to ICE that I have a passport. I don't need a visa. I can go tomorrow to my country, and I am willing to do that. They said, no, we have to wait.
He would try appealing, and then there would be different court dates, and, like, nothing would come out of it, and then different promises. And then at the end, they told us, if you just leave voluntarily, we promised he'll be on the flight with you. We kept expecting to find my father there, and he didn't show up. At the end, the immigration officer told him, he's like, I can't respond to your questions anymore.
After almost 3 years in prison, two of those in solitary confinement, Sami Hammoudi was found innocent of all terrorism charges. But instead of being released, he was transferred to an immigration jail. For 6 months, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, refused to either release or deport him, even after he agreed to voluntary deportation to reunite with his family. Hammoudi's lawyers brought ICE to court. 2 days before the trial, Hammoudi was deported in secret.
So on the 23rd, they took me to the airport and deported me. So it wasn't their plan to deport me this way. If we didn't go to the federal judge and ask him to either release me or deport me, they wouldn't do that.
We didn't even know, because we were used to him calling, and then he didn't call for 2 days, so we didn't know what was going on. And my mom called his lawyer, and he didn't, like, have an idea of what's going on, and we kept trying to get in touch with people. And, like, she was kind of freaking out, because it was just, you couldn't get in touch with him. No one knew what was happening to him.
It's the humiliation of, being deported and traveling in a T-shirt and sweatpants and prison shoes and having these agents with you. It's especially for somebody who has my good name and my reputation are the only assets I have in this world. I mean, I don't have any money in any bank accounts. I don't have any land. I don't have any. But this is the only thing I have. And the U.S. government made sure to attack me on these two. They have ruined my reputation. They have ruined my good name. And they have accused me unjustly of things that are complete fabrications. They could not prove anything because there was nothing there. But with the USA Patriot Act, they didn't have to prove anything. It was enough for the government to say, we suspect.
They think that accusing people, destroying their lives, is something they can do. This is what worries me. It is the arrogance of the powerful.
Sometimes I think back and I don't even know. Like, it still seems like a dream in a way. And I don't really know how we got through all of it. It seems like it was something that even happened to someone else.
America before, I won't say before September 11th, America before the USA Patriot Act was one thing, and after the USA Patriot Act was a completely different country. I will not be exaggerating if I said America today is a police state just like any other third world police states.
It is actually the Dark Ages. It is the mentality of the Dark Ages, where governments could do anything they wanted to do.
In criminal court, the burden of proof is with the prosecution. They would have to make their case. They would have to prove. In immigration, all they have to do is just cast doubt upon them.
They do whatever they want to do. And they have the laws. They have everything they want to lie, even lie.
All these things that you hear about, freedom and, equality and all these other things, it just seemed like more and more of a facade. And it was just, I don't know. Like, the hypocrisy was just kind of overwhelming, and just having to deal with that uncertainty on a daily basis was just very nerve-wracking and very exhausting.
You can't imagine.